what's for lunch, and specifically what's for lunch at school for your child. School lunches are one of the topics we'll look at on Focus today as we welcome back dietitian and nutritionist David Grotto, author of The Best Things You Can Eat. I'm Jim Meadows, and David will talk about the best lunch food your kid could be eating, whether it comes from school or from home. Plus, what does it mean to be gluten-free? Now that the FDA has issued legally binding rules for gluten-free foods, we can talk about the specific reasons for avoiding gluten or not. David Grotto, that's today on Focus on WYLL. Our program begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and today's show is devoted to diet and nutrition. We'll be taking your calls and emails with your questions on the subject. And to answer those questions, we welcome back David Grotto. He's a registered dietitian and a licensed dietitian nutritionist based in the Chicago area. He's the president and founder of Nutrition House Call, a nutrition consulting firm. And you can find David Grotto's Nutrition House Call website linked to our website. Just go to will.illinois.edu/focus. David's latest book is The Best Things You Can Eat. David Grotto, welcome back to Focus.
Jim, it's great to be back on again. Thanks for having me.
Well, I thought we would start the conversation talking about talking about school lunches, since kids are back in school now in most places, and that means they're going back to school lunches. We had we had seen some news reports. As a matter of fact, a local school district was involved in these news reports that some school districts are dropping out of the National School Lunch Program, the federally subsidized school lunch programs, because the new federal guidelines for healthier foods in the lunches are essentially unpopular with kids. I guess the incident we had here, the Catlin School District in Vermilion County dropped out of the program. Its superintendent, Gary Lewis, says too many of the kids were just throwing the food away. They would get it and then they would toss it. And some were actually going hungry instead, leading to behavior problems later in the day. Superintendent Lewis says they now offer a menu with more options, with things like fish sticks and hamburgers and some of the things I remember from my school lunches, alongside, they note, the healthier stuff. What do you make of this as far as the battle to get the right foods into your kids?
Well, it's tough. It's certainly a conundrum, because one of the challenges that the school lunch program faces is that when we implement new policy about how children should be eating, if that doesn't mirror what they're doing at home, it may be a hard sell. And I think that's exactly what we're finding now in school lunches. Interestingly, when the new guidelines were released, one of the things that I had asked for is that there would be mandatory testing of what are called tray waste studies. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of formal tray waste studies that are being done. And in essence, what that does is it looks at what are the children either returning to the conveyor belt that takes the trays and then people manually take off the dishes and clean them, and or looking at what's being dumped in the trash can. And then talking to several school food lunch directors at a variety of different schools, what we're finding is that the fruits and vegetables and healthy whole grains and so forth, many of those foods are actually not winding up in the children's stomachs, but actually winding up in the trash can. So it is a one step forward and one step back in many scenarios. Now, I certainly think it's important that we don't give up the fight here, but I think it illustrates that the school lunch program is one component of improving the health and nutrition of children, but we've got to get parents involved.
I'm wondering, and let's follow up on that. When you say get parents involved, what sort of involvement are we talking about?
Well, I think the involvement is that what happens at home often translates into those selections at school. So parents can either elect to pack a lunch for their children, and especially if they're finding that they're not liking the selections of the school lunch program. However, the theme should still be, whether they're purchasing a lunch at school or they're having one packed at home, that the school should meet nutritional guidelines. And I think that's one of the parts where this is really falling through the cracks, is that parents really are not being involved in the entire process. Quite often they send their kids off to school, and then maybe unbeknownst to them, their child is not consuming all the food, and then that can be linked to poor performance, poor attendance, you know, the list goes on. So I think there needs to be a national outreach to educate parents about what is a healthy lunch that they can pack for their children, what's a healthy breakfast that they can start their children off before the beginning of the day, because we do know that when children miss meals and they eat inadequately, and this has been well documented in studies in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Pediatrics, the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, you know, the list goes on, that math scores, attendance, coming late, tardiness, so forth, is severely impacted with inadequate consumption of food.
Well, we want to hear your questions about diet and nutrition and maybe some of the experiences you've had with school lunches and getting your kids to eat them. Give us a call. The number, toll-free, is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. David, is there anything about the way the food is presented? I mean, I don't remember the kitchen at my high school back in the 1970s being the world's finest restaurant. And if food is prepared off-site, which is I think what many schools have to contend with, the food just may not be as appetizing as advertised, even in the best of circumstances.
Well, you know, not only am I a registered dietitian, but I've worked in food service, hospital food service specifically, but worked hand-in-hand with school administrators. And some of the dilemmas and challenges that school food service administrators have is that when you're preparing food, it has to hold up well on a tray line. So if someone has, let's say, a later lunch, that casserole may not be as eye-appealing as maybe when it was first put out. So not only does it have to meet nutrition standards, but the bottom line is that food has to sell. And if that food item is not being selected by children, that's going to be off the menu. So everybody has kind of a vested interest to make sure that's a palatable selection. And I think one of the key components, and a lot of schools are actually doing this, is getting students as well as parents involved with the menu planning there to make sure it's more representative of what children actually like. Dr. Brian Wansink from Cornell University actually did some very interesting research looking at positioning of foods within the school cafeteria. And when they started putting more fruits and vegetables and low-fat dairy and healthier options kind of more eyesight and first and foremost and center, they found that children more naturally selected those foods. So there's a lot to it beyond just the component of eating healthy at home, but indeed even how to set up the school cafeteria for optimal eating may be imperative as well.
There's presentation is important even in a school in a school lunchroom.
Yeah, we eat with our eyes first, so it's got to be not only healthy, and in fact, I often tell school administrators, leave health off the menu, and especially when it comes to kids, because they don't care. That what they want is something that's going to be delicious. It's going to fill their stomach, you know, after hours of classes, and it should be fun. And there's no reason that fun and appearance and nutrition can't coexist.
Well, let's look at the other option, which is, you know, sending a lunch out with your kid. And I have to admit, when I was in the States, that was being done for me. It was a lot like what you read in the Peanuts comic strip, like a couple of peanut butter sandwiches and a banana. Would that be a good option, by the way?
Well, I'll tell you, it's better than no food, and I shouldn't make too light of that, because we do have a big problem with food insufficiency in this country. So, you know, many children across socioeconomic levels are going to school hungry. either self-electing, and I always use my two daughters as a great example. You know, I'm fortunate enough that a lot of what I do for work is from home, and so I'm honored and feel very privileged that I have an opportunity to get them to start off their day with a good meal, because left to their own volition, I can guarantee you after makeup and hair is done, my daughters would be out the door without anything in their stomach and then complaining hours later. So first and foremost, it's almost regardless of what you're eating, it's better to eat something than nothing at all. And too many, I think, parents draw the line in the sand about being too perfect about what they're giving their children. Now, nothing wrong with having high standards, but there is research that suggests that it's not just any breakfast that's going to, you know, improve performance and make your children not overeat at the next meal because they're ravenous. There is research that suggests that we should have more of a protein-forward breakfast, and the sweet spot seems to be somewhere between 20 and 30 grams of protein. Most adults and children are usually trying to put a bar or a bowl of cereal with a little splash of milk on it, and usually are woefully shy of the protein. The reason that that's so important is that protein actually plays a role in helping to keep you attentive and also has a satiety effect. So if your stomach is growling and you're paying more attention to that hunger pang than you are to the lessons that are to be learned at school, that can impact you academically.
Okay, so pulling away from lunch and going to the first meal of the day, and if there should be 20 to 30 grams of protein there and the bowl of cereal isn't going to do it, what's a good rule of thumb for what will work in getting that protein component in the meal?
Absolutely. Well, you know, so we should look at what are those good sources of protein. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I am working with the Milk Pep program, which is the milk education wing of the dairy industry. But the reason that I partnered with them is that I often found in my own house that we use milk, but it's usually just a splash to make the cereal wet. And if we're trying to get to the 20, 30 grams, quite often what's put on there might only be a couple grams. So a full 8-ounce glass of milk would be an example of 8 grams. Okay. So what you could also add with that is you could have an egg. An egg is 7 grams, so now you're up to 14. You can certainly augment that by having either additional egg whites to, you know, throw in a couple of more to boost that to another 7, and you're basically there. So that's just one of many different examples. Oatmeal in the morning is something that we love at our house. But if you make it traditionally with water, it's not as significant of a protein boost as if you swapped out that water, let's say, with a low-fat milk. So those are just a few simple examples. But, you know, for example, with my daughters, we often default to a breakfast smoothie. So I can really kind of jazz it up a little bit. So I can throw in some oats, and I can throw in some milk, and I can throw in some protein powder and a variety of different fruits, and they literally have a meal in a glass, and they can bring that with them if they're running late for school.
Assuming you have the time for it, breakfast meats, do they provide the protein, or do they provide too much of other things?
Well, you can certainly get leaner bacon and sausages and things of that nature. You know, we do know that we want to keep our saturated fat and cholesterol down. So breakfast meats historically have been a fairly significant source of saturated fat and cholesterol and calories. But the good news is there are some leaner options out there. So you can get turkey sausages, you can get vegetarian sausages out there. Two of my three daughters actually were kind of flexitarians. You know, they try to avoid animal proteins, but they still like the taste of it. So we experimented with vegetarian sausages and so forth, and they were absolutely delicious. So
well, I'm wondering then, when we're talking about meat substitutes, do they provide the sort of protein that meats do?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it is not only protein, but it's about high-quality protein. High-quality protein is defined as having all of the essential amino acids. And so in my book, The Best Things You Can Eat, I actually have a quintessential list of protein foods. And much to the chagrin of vegans, what definitely tops the list are those animal-based proteins, because they do have all the branched-chain amino acids, all the essential amino acids. Now, soy, for example, is also a plant-based protein that does also contain all of the essential amino acids. The reason I bring that also up is that I've seen a lot of people making more of a switch to drinking, let's say, rice milk or almond milk. You know, those are fine beverages if you're looking for hydration, but if you're looking for them to replace dairy milk, they really don't hold a candle to the protein content of dairy milk.
But soy milk, you think, would do a better job?
Well, that's going to be the closest that you're going to get to dairy milk. And again, without going beyond the protein content, there are other nutrients that both of those beverages provide. So it's not really even comparing apples to oranges or soy milk to regular milk.
Well, I guess apples.
Each has its different properties. Yep.
Okay. We're talking about diet and nutrition today with dietitian and nutritionist David Grotto. His books include The Best Things to Eat, published earlier this year by DiCapo Lifelong Books. And David Grotto works in a spokesman capacity with Milk Pep, as you mentioned before, the education wing of the dairy industry, and the vitamin company Nature Made Supplements, and the California Strawberry Commission. We welcome your questions at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free at 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Well, assuming we at least have a little framework for how to handle breakfast, what about lunch? What about if you're sending a lunch with your child to school, what are the best options?
Sure, absolutely. And what I would suggest also is that the USDA actually has a great website, and many people are probably familiar that the old-fashioned food guide pyramid has now been replaced with the My Plate guideline icon. So you can go to myplate.gov, and there you will see some great recommendations, great visual recommendations of how to translate food that we should be eating into the proper portions. So the first rule of thumb when you're packing a lunch, and again referring back to My Plate, is half of the plate should be fruits and vegetables. That can be any fruits that are in season, and as you just mentioned, I do some work with California strawberries. I am particularly preferential to berries of all types because they are lower in sugars compared to a lot of other different fruit. Have a less calorie content per volume, meaning that you're looking at about 50 calories on average per cup, and just packed with obviously a lot of those nutrients, especially phytochemicals that may actually improve cognition. So my daughters, you can bet the farm that if they've got a big test coming up for the days preceding, I'm kind of loading them up with a lot of berries. So that would be something that you could pack into a lunch. Vegetables, that could be a soup, having a little small thermos of soup. So even using like a pureed vegetable, it doesn't actually have to look like a stalk of broccoli if your kids don't like that, but maybe they would much rather have it in a stew or a soup. That would be fine. Or you can certainly pack some fresh vegetables with their favorite dip. A lot of people say, well, gee, what about all the extra fat and calories that you're getting from the dip? And to me, dips are a great gateway to making sure that those vegetables are consumed. So I think the benefit far outweighs any sort of negative.
Okay. I don't know if I missed something there, if I haven't heard any room for the traditional sandwich in that lunch menu. Is there still room for that sort of thing?
Sure, and I'm sorry, let me work my way around the plate. So we talked about fruits and vegetables, grains, about a quarter of the plate should be grains. So I would probably argue that you want to, you certainly could make a full sandwich. I also grew up with the traditional one or two, and believe it or not, sometimes three peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Sounds fine to me, but you're suggesting maybe not that much.
Well, and let's deconstruct a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So, and one of my patients who I just recently went to their home to look at their environment that they were eating, this gentleman was about 450 pounds, and one of his favorite snacks was having two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches before he went to bed. And in deconstructing the sandwich, I just had him put on ad lib the amount of peanut butter that he would normally do. Then I took out a traditional tablespoon measurer, which all the bakers out there will know that when you're measuring something like peanut butter, you have to scrape the top of it off to get it level to know what truly is one tablespoon. So one tablespoon of peanut butter equals 100 calories. This gentleman, and it didn't look very thick, had about 10 tablespoons per sandwich. So we're looking at 1,000 calories just from the peanut butter alone, not including the bread and the jelly. So I started looking at that sandwich, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, maybe that's not so far-fetched because the ones that Mom used to make for me were pretty robust and thick there, too. So I can guarantee you nobody needs 10 tablespoons of peanut butter on their sandwich. So one of the things that I suggest is you can have that traditional peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but take about 2 tablespoons on there and then fill up the rest of the sandwich with some sliced fruit such as bananas, strawberries, you can put sliced grapes, and then you have much more robust sandwich and a lot less calories.
And the fresh fruit is sort of replacing the taste effect of the jelly.
Correct. Now, you can certainly put jelly on there, but in order to make that sandwich kind of moist and tasty, what I often find is that you have to put in more than a couple of teaspoons, which you've got about 60 calories right there, and so you can add a significant amount of sugar and calories by loading up on too much jelly. But what I have found is just taking some in-season fruit and slicing it up on that sandwich gives you the same effect, a lot less calories, and a lot more nutrition.
Could you talk to me a little bit, because I've seen other stuff talking about this, the virtues of fruit versus fruit juices.
Yes. Well, fruit juice, I think, does have its virtues, but unfortunately, the traditional fruit juice glass has morphed into what we would normally drink, a tumbler full of water. So where it used to be 4 ounces of juice with a meal, in many households I'm seeing kids are drinking these 12 to 14, 16-ounce tumblers of juice. And if you look at the calorie per ounce, the calories in juice is very similar to the calories that you would get in soda. So though I am a big proponent of eating fruit, I don't think you should drink your fruit servings for the day because a lot of the fiber and potentially some of the nutrients may be missing in the juice. However, a 4-ounce glass of juice to have with a meal certainly can be an option for fruit.
Now, I see these little cardboard boxes of individual servings of fruit juice for kids. Is that 4 ounces or more? And is that strictly fruit juice, or is it often with a lot of sugar added?
Yes, or no, I should say. So not all of the juice boxes are a standard 4 ounce. That's a great question. And not all the boxes out there are strictly 100% juice. So advice for the consumer is definitely look for 4-ounce portions and definitely look for 100% juice claim on the label. And when in doubt, just turn to the list of ingredients. If you see anything else besides 100% juice in that ingredient list, usually I recommend putting it back, especially if you're seeing sugar added to it. So then it becomes, instead of a fruit juice, it becomes a fruit drink.
Okay, so you should be careful with the label as to exactly what it is. Are there certain words that you can be should be looking for?
Absolutely. And just a guideline for some of the label reading, again, the USDA website, myplate.gov, also the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, eatright.org also has some great consumer information there as well.
So phrases like 100% juice, does that mean all clear or?
Yeah, 100% juice is all clear. That's a good thing. But again, putting into perspective, all of your fruit servings for the day should not be comprised of juice because you do miss something when you are going from a whole fruit to a juice and primarily fiber. So that's one of the other things. You're also getting volume when you're eating fruit at a lower calorie density. You could be drinking a tumbler full of juice, which is going to give you 3 fruit servings, but you're not going to feel as satisfied. And kind of that immediate concentrated sugar can also trigger this insulin reaction where your body is kind of preferentially storing it as fat, and that can just make you, again, feel more hungry because you're pumping out more insulin, which is going to just lower your blood sugar. It's kind of a vicious cycle where eating whole fruit makes that more of a virtuous cycle.
Whole fruit just sounds like it just slows the whole process down compared
That's it. When in doubt, eat whole.
The word natural, if you see that on a label, does that mean anything?
Well, you know, death is natural, and it's not something we're trying to achieve any earlier than we'd like. So, unfortunately, it's a very nebulous word. It doesn't really give the consumer any clear guidance about the nutrition value of that food. So I often say if you see the word natural on there, that's another reason to do a double take and really check out the label. Cholesterol-free is another one that's I always chuckle at, because if you see cholesterol-free on a package of fruit, know that if the food that you're eating never once had a face or a liver, it never had cholesterol anyhow. So, and this is kind of all about that health halo, and I think as part of our agenda today, we were going to be talking about gluten-free. That's yet another term that people really do need to be aware of, that that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a healthier product. It simply means that it's gluten-free. So there's a lot of terminology out there that can be very confusing.
And I want to get to the gluten thing in a minute. I wanted to bring in an email I got from Ryan, who was Ryan has apparently seen the documentary Forks Over Knives. Are you familiar with this?
You know, I have not had the opportunity to see it, so I may not be the best guest to comment on it, but maybe go ahead and ask the question and I'll see if there is something.
Okay, well, there is a website for the documentary if anybody wants to look. It's forksoverknives.com. The headline at the top of the website, Prevent and Reverse Disease with a Whole Food Plant-Based Diet. Ryan writes that the documentary has a very strong anti-milk stance along with meats. Ryan's personal opinion, while I hear their argument, no one is going to take my eggs, bacon, milk, or coffee away.
Right.
For instance, the question about the virtues of meats and dairy versus plant-based equivalents.
Sure. Well, that I can definitely talk to. One of the things that I did in my former nutrition life is I was the director of nutrition of a heart disease reversal program that was based on the work of Dr. Dean Ornish, very well documented. And that was a very plant-forward, nearly vegan diet, with the exception of it did allow a little bit of fish and one cup of non-fat dairy products a day. And what they found with people following that type of dietary program is not only were they able to halt the progression of plaque formation called atherosclerosis, but they actually did show through tomography and CAT scans the reversal, the actual decrease of plaque formation in those arteries. So that was done with some animal products within the diet. If we take a look around the world at those cultures that have the least amount historically of heart disease, and the reason I say historically is if we look at a Mediterranean diet and those cultures that follow it, there's many Mediterranean regions that are no longer following a traditional Mediterranean diet. But that diet, which has lean dairy and meat products in smaller portions, absolutely has been shown to be beneficial for helping to control weight, diabetes, heart disease, and so forth. So to me, a vegan diet is absolutely can be, if well planned, a very healthy diet, and it's a personal choice. But I think those that are saying that you have to go 100% plant-based diet to enjoy good health, I think there's very little research that supports that you have to go 100% vegan to be in good health.
So it's that raises the question. It does sound like what would be considered a reasonable amount of meat and dairy products is certainly okay as compared to gigantic or at least larger proportions.
Correct. But it is about, yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. I think, I always like to use the term plant forward, not plant only. So I think all of the experts, and again, the ones that sat on the dietary committee for the dietary guidelines for Americans, if you take a look at the kind of the big difference as the evolution of those guidelines have rolled out over the years is this whole, you know, half your plate fruits and vegetables. So the majority of what people should be eating are fruits and vegetables, but it shouldn't be only fruits and vegetables.
So it would actually be more difficult. It sounds like you're saying it's not impossible, but more difficult to have a non-meat, non-dairy diet, a vegan diet or something close to it.
Yeah, and this is coming from someone who has practiced that before. Before I met my wife, I was a card-carrying vegan raw foodist. So yet another level of complexity. Not only did I eat, you know, no animal products, but I also, you know, they couldn't be cooked over a certain temperature and so forth. So not surprisingly, I was left off the list of many social functions, you know, as I brown bagged it, and that got old very quickly. But, you know, did I feel good during that time? Absolutely. So it can be a healthy diet, but you have to be very tenacious about making sure that it's well planned. So that's why we see a variety of different healthy diets throughout the world. You know, so does the Mediterranean diet stake claim only to a healthy diet? No. Traditional Asian diets. I have a very dear friend of mine who just wrote a book about a Peruvian diet. A traditional Peruvian diet can be very healthy. So you can find good health all around the world.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, and we will be right back with more talk about diet and nutrition with dietitian and nutritionist David Grotto. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WYLL. And welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, and our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. David Grotto is with us today on Focus, answering your questions about diet and nutrition. And as you noted, we did have a question about gluten-free foods, because the FDA recently announced the first binding rules regulating what foods can be called gluten-free. And, you know, for some people, this is serious stuff. If you have an allergy or other ailments which are triggered by gluten in the diet, it's really important to know if your foods are gluten-free, or even if you're gluten-sensitive, which I understand is less severe, is still a problem. What do you know about these new rules, and do they make a difference?
Yeah, you know, and I'm really glad that you pointed out that this can be very serious for those that have those wheat and gluten intolerance, and I'll give some definitions of what gluten is and what grains contain them and so forth. First of all, there is a condition called celiac disease, which is basically an abnormal immune response to the protein content of certain grains called gluten, and this can damage the lining of the small intestine. And this disease has been associated with not only malabsorption of nutrients, meaning that you're not absorbing all the ones that you should, but can have a variety of other different symptoms, such as bloating and gas and abdominal pains, even ranking up to canker sores and joint pain and menstrual periods. It's amazing. So the more and more research of what can happen if you have celiac disease is pretty profound. However, to quote Dr. Peter Green, who is the director of the Celiac Disease Center at Columbia University, he has found that many people who are selecting gluten-free products at the grocery store don't have celiac disease, the vast majority, as he's saying, or even a sensitivity to those grains that have gluten-free. So what's happened in my earlier statement is that sometimes this terminology imparts a health halo to food. So here we saw, and poor Miley Cyrus seems to be taking quite a beating in the media recently over the VMAs, but prior to that, she made a statement that she was following a gluten-free diet to manage her weight and for better health. If we take a look at the research, there is a gaping hole in any sort of research showing that a gluten-free diet somehow is better for you than a regular diet, or may help you lose weight, apart from the benefits that you would get if you have to avoid those foods that contain gluten. So gluten, again, is a protein typically found in those grains, and the acronym I always like to use is BROW, barley, rye, oats, and wheat. And the oats part typically is not that they have gluten in them, but they're more guilty by association. The major oat manufacturers in this country and Canada and so forth may actually transport those oats in containers that once contained wheat, rye, or barley. So that's something for someone who is looking to avoid gluten in oats. You want to make sure you find a manufacturer that says gluten-free on it.
Okay, and if you don't have a problem with gluten or a gluten sensitivity, is gluten something that is beneficial? Is it something that is particularly beneficial?
Well, I wouldn't say it's particularly beneficial. It is a plant protein. There's no problem with that. But those foods that typically contain gluten also typically tend to be major sources of these nutrients in the American diet. It's iron, calcium, fiber, thiamine, also known as vitamin B1, riboflavin, B2, niacin, and folate. And quite often, folate is added to those grains because there had been a problem with neurotube defects in America, and then that was almost resolved with fortification of foods. So whole grain products, typically whole wheat, are often fortified. So there can be a risk of not getting adequate amount of these nutrients if those people that are following a gluten-free diet are not planning well.
People who are on gluten-free diets, what are they using as substitutes for those basic grains that you mentioned?
Sure, absolutely. So in my book, The Best Things That You Can Eat, I actually have the best gluten-free grains, and the best gluten-free grains are basically all gluten-free grains. So those would contain amaranth, which is an ancient grain of the Andes, buckwheat. Now, interestingly enough, my daughter discovered that she had a buckwheat allergy, and again, buckwheat is gluten-free. But, you know, that's a very rare thing that people might have an allergy to a grain. So I do want to differentiate between having a gluten sensitivity or intolerance versus having a out-and-out allergy. Millet, again, oats, as I mentioned, are gluten-free as long as they're not transported in gluten-containing containers. Quinoa, sorghum, and teff. So a lot of those grains are not part of the typical American diet.
But
those are what you're finding in a lot of the gluten-free foods out there.
Are those grains common in other parts of the world? Because I'm just thinking there are a lot of grains out there, but maybe a relatively small variety of grains that we tend to eat here in America.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, quinoa has grown in popularity, so we're starting to see a lot more being grown here in the United States, though the history of quinoa actually stems from the Incan cultures, so South America, and in fact, they used to make what were called war balls out of them. They would cook the quinoa and add in beef fat or animal fat and human blood, and they would eat that before they would go off to war for super energy. Of course, I wouldn't recommend that today. But, you know, you can get quinoa at any grocery store now. It's very common. Sorghum throughout the world is probably more popular outside of the United States than in the United States. That is generally a cash crop that is grown to help, you know, supply basic nutrition. Teff, actually translated the word teff, means lost. It's a grain that's so small that if you drop it on the floor, you're going to have a hard time finding it. Teff is very nutritious, and you'll typically find that more in Africa as a staple. There's a bread called injera that's delicious. It's an unleavened bread, and that's made from that grain.
Okay. We have an email that came in from Mike, who has wonders if you could talk about the issue of pesticides on fruits and vegetables. Mike writes, "I'd come at this from a practical rather than an ideological angle. That is, I have no problem eating conventionally grown produce as long as it is safe. I have read some advice that indicates there is a bigger difference in domestic versus foreign produce rather than non-organic versus organic produce. Is this true? All advice appreciated."
Oh, glad to answer that, and I would first of all say that I'm a nutrition, not a pesticide expert. However, interestingly enough, you know, Stanford University, as you may recall or may have heard of, actually did a side-by-side comparison of organic versus conventional produce to see which one won as far as nutrition status, and they found virtually no difference between the two. Some cases, organic might be slightly higher in nutrients, some cases, conventional. So when I have to see a family that's struggling to put food on the table and they're watching their food budget, it's very difficult for me to look them in the eye and say, hey, it makes sense to have that uptick cost to go ahead and substantiate buying an organic versus conventional. The research, I think, is, and again, if you take a look at the research, practically 95% plus has been done on conventional produce, not organic produce, when it looks at the health benefits of it. Now, from a pesticide standpoint and food safety, there is probably no more rigorous standards in the world than what California has imposed on farmers there. So thus my preference, and as you mentioned before, I do some spokesperson work for California Strawberries, and California Strawberry Commission represents both organic and conventional. So one of the things that I always tell people to do is whatever produce that you get, always make sure that you wash it off. And rinsing produce actually can substantially reduce what minimal residue of pesticides that there may be on there. So that would be my advice. Again, I have not seen too much research out there showing that produce that we're getting here in the United States, properly handled, washed, has been a significant health problem at all, and quite the opposite.
Okay, but again, it sounds like the emphasis on washing, and maybe dealing with organic produce as well, but just washing as a matter of course.
Sure, and certainly we've already heard of salmonella poisoning from organic produce from using, manure and things of that nature. So,
can washing be a precaution in that case that'll be useful for if there is that sort of danger in the case of salmonella? Can you wash off that sort of thing?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not always a guarantee. So that, certainly why, when we saw with the organic spinach debacle that happened, so there's more stricter standards of what can be used for fertilizer and so forth in organic farming. Washing is the best thing that you can do. Next best thing would certainly be to cook your fruits and vegetables, and so forth. But that's why I always say that getting produce from the United States, and I think especially the state of California, which has the most rigorous food safety standards in the world, would be your best bet. It's not 100% assurance that you'll never have a problem, but you have a less likely odd of having difficulties.
We still have some time for your questions about diet and nutrition for David Grotto, and our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And we're also taking questions at Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Circling back to our earlier discussion about school lunches, and I think at one point we got into the area about presentation in the lunchroom. Lisa tweets, I think this point about presentation of food at lunchtime is completely underrated, and I was thinking of something that our producer came across, producer Lindsay Moon came across in researching for today's show, and that would seem to be some interest, at least on some circles, for the use of something like the bento box, which I gather comes from Japan, for a way of bringing in your school lunch.
Absolutely. So a nod to Lisa. She is absolutely right. I often say nutrition is not the first word that should be coming out of the mouths. It should be about taste. It should be about enjoyment and presentation as part of that experience. And then maybe it should be the, oh, by the way, it happened to be good for you. And that applies to not only children, but I think that also applies to adults. The bento box, a brilliant invention, of course, those that are familiar with the bento box probably do know that it originated in Japan. And certainly there are some traditional foods that we would often find in a bento box. Typically in Japan, it might be packed with foods such as rice and fish, a little bit of meat, vegetables, pickled vegetables, maybe even a little small offering of dessert. But what's so neat about the bento box is that they actually have individual components that you can keep the food. So if you have kids like me, even in their teen years, that they're worried that one food touches another food and that's a deal breaker of whether they're going to eat it, that's the beauty of the bento box. It keeps foods, you know, contained. And by the way, I have no affiliation with, you know, any company that makes bento boxes, but I'm just, you know, very thrilled.
Although I say if you Google bento box, you'll find some for sale, and I can imagine you could take some conventional plastic containers and convert them, or else you could buy some bento boxes online, which are insufferably cute.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they all come in different colors, and you know, there's and again, I have no affiliation. There's one that's called laptoplaunches.com. And actually, what I love about their website is, remember I was talking about the food pyramid now being converted into the My Plate icon. They now took that My Plate icon, broke it down into what it should look like in the bento boxes, and they give you exact amounts that actually go into those little compartments. So they've really made the guesswork out of eating healthy you know, out of it, out of the equation, which is fantastic. So, you know, and what I think what's really nice about the bento box is my kids actually find it fun. You know, they love eating from the little individual compartments. It's bright and colorful. It stores things, and it keeps it under refrigeration because you can get actually thermal insulated covers for the bento boxes. But what a lot of the initial research, and there's not a ton of research, but the initial research coming out, and in fact, the weight management center in La Jolla, California, has been doing some research in there that looked at, this is truly a method of calorie and portion control. You can only cram so much food in each component. But the visual of looking at that bento box when you open it up makes it look like it's a large amount of food. And again, back to a nod to Dr. Brian Wansink from Cornell, talked about the benefits of eating off of small plates, because when people eat and they see that their plate is full, psychologically they feel like they really got a big meal.
That's interesting. Sometimes I think that there's a trend towards large plates in a lot of American dining, because there are a lot of companies who want to sell you as much food as possible. And this is and there's a separate psychological effect when you go in that direction. And this is an effort to work against that and sort of rein things back in.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of be careful what you ask. You know, consumers had an outcry for being overfed at a restaurant, and then when restaurants stepped up to the plate, maybe pun intended, they started downsizing the portions, and consumers felt that they were not getting their value and were rebelling. So it's not surprising now that when I start seeing restaurants who have either called out foods as being healthy on the menu, not surprising those are the least selected, or if they start decreasing the portion sizes, consumers actually do rebel. So I think what we need to do is be consistent and truly honor what we're asking for. Now, one of the ways of getting around that is just assume every time you go to a restaurant, you're going to be overfed. Take that to the bank. So one of the techniques that I share with my patients is to immediately ask the wait staff to wrap half of the meal up, even before it gets to the table. So again, you've taken that food kind of out of the equation. Now, of course, if you're desperate enough, you have to open up the, you know, container and so forth. But I think that calls more attention to yourself. So try that technique, and it's been very effective for a lot of my patients.
Okay, you do have to be you do have to take initiative there in that sort of case, and not just take what's being served to you.
Well, quite often I think that's the problem, is that there can be this blame shifting. Oh, the restaurant overfed me. You know, there are children starving in Elmhurst, Illinois, where I'm at. No, that's not the reason why you should be overeating. It should be that you eat until you're full and you stop when you're full. But unfortunately, we've lost that connection of what it means to be physically full. So a technique I use with my patients, that I actually ask them to put their fork down, or the weapon down, between each mouthful and ask themselves this question: can I walk away from the table now and be satisfied? And quite often that happens way before half of the meal is consumed. But many people feel, you know, again, subconsciously, because they've had mom and dad telling them that it's sinful and wasteful to waste food, but mom and dad unfortunately didn't give the parallel message, which should have been, it's sinful to overeat and cause obesity and diabetes and heart disease and so forth.
Well, I'm looking at the website of Laptop Lunches, and it does look like the units they sell would be a good way for portion control. It also looks like the sort of thing that, you know, there are a lot of plastic containers being sold out there. This is something that you could improvise yourself, perhaps at a in a lower price range, and maybe once you got started, that would simplify the whole meal making, the lunch making process in the morning.
Absolutely. You know, so we have a variety of different Tupperware containers that we could probably construct into a little traditional lunchbox and accomplish the same thing. So yes, I think listeners don't necessarily have to feel compelled to go out and do that, but we all know that we like simplicity and convenience, so that may be an option.
Well, David Grotta, we're just about out of time today, but I wanted to thank you for taking us through the process of figuring out lunch and figuring out gluten, and hope to have you on again sometime. We can figure out some more things about diet and nutrition in the future.
Well, something to chew on. My pleasure.
Our thanks to David Grotta. He is the author of The Best Things to Eat from DeCapo Lifelong Books, and you'll find a link to his Nutrition House Call website at our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus, or just search for us with the words WYLL Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Focus is taking Labor Day off. Tune in Monday morning at 10 for a documentary from the American Radio Works series that looks at the rise of customized learning in American schools and how educators are finding ways to bring individualized attention to school children in a school system that many assumed was fated to be one size fits all. One child at a time, custom learning in the digital age. That's coming up Monday, Labor Day, at 10 a.m. on AM 580, and Focus returns Tuesday morning with the story of a remarkable crime ring that stole not money or jewelry or gold, but rare books. Focus is on each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. on AM 580. This is Focus on WYLL.